This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on voluntary versus involuntary manslaughter. I am joined by Senior Barrister Simon Spence QC from Red Lion Chambers in London. Simon has successfully prosecuted and defended numerous very high-profile and fatal violent offences for many years. His cases have included a number of highly complex matters which have attracted national and international media attention. Simon also is ranked in the Legal 500 and in Chambers and Partners. Simon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. This is a heavy one, right? So this title is quite a heavy one.
Yes.
We're going to try and make it very light and interesting so that people can really get a grasp of it without having to read lots and lots and lots of books and things. So murder and manslaughter are two of the offences that constitute murder, and the words voluntary and involuntary are terms that we are familiar with. But how do we distinguish between involuntary and voluntary manslaughter? In both cases, a death has occurred. We all know that for someone to be guilty of murder, they must have committed a guilty act and had the intention to commit a crime, to have unlawfully caused a death, as well as having the intention to cause grievous bodily harm. In this episode, together with my amazing guest, Simon, we will bring you interesting, informative and jargon-free conversation on what these differences are and much more in plain and simple English. Simon, firstly, let's explain so that people get it. What is meant by manslaughter and why the charge or conviction is not known as murder?
Murder is the unlawful killing of another person with the intention either to kill them or to cause them really serious harm. And if all of those elements are present, then subject to a number of exceptions, which we'll talk about, that person is guilty of murder. So far, so good and easy to understand.
Yes.
Manslaughter is a much more complicated offence and one that I think a lot of people don't fully understand. And to be honest, the use of the words voluntary and involuntary don't really help.
Excellent. We're on a good start then.
Well, voluntary suggests something that you choose to do.
Yes.
Can I start with involuntary manslaughter first
of all? Yes.
Because involuntary manslaughter is perhaps an easier one to understand. Involuntary manslaughter is an unlawful killing of another person, but without the intention required for murder. In other words, without an intention to kill or to cause grievous bodily harm. And there are two types of involuntary manslaughter.
Oh, one is called breaks down a bit more.
Unlawful act. It does. And when we get to voluntary manslaughter, it gets even more complicated.
Excellent.
Unlawful act manslaughter is the carrying out of an unlawful act which results in death, and one where all sober and reasonable people would inevitably realise that that subjects the person who dies to at least some form of harm.
Involuntary.
That's involuntary manslaughter. That's all that's required. Harm obviously means some physical harm. And so if you expose somebody to harm in an unlawful act, which any ordinary person would realise would subject that person to harm, you're guilty of involuntary manslaughter.
Okay. Now, so far, I'm with you.
The other way that involuntary manslaughter can be committed is if you carry out an act which is grossly negligent. And involuntary manslaughter in this sense is something that's often found, for example, in the workplace, where there's an unsafe system of work, somebody suffers a serious accident and dies from their injuries. And there has to be for that a duty of care owed by someone to the person who dies, a breach of that duty of care, and a breach that is so serious that it is regarded as being criminal, not just civil. Now, gross negligence manslaughter is a topic all of its own.
No. That's a separate podcast, you see, because I'm starting to lose my thread. Because we said, right, what is meant by manslaughter?
Yeah.
And why is it not known as murder?
Let's park gross negligence manslaughter, because that is a whole topic all of its own. And so involuntary manslaughter, for today's purposes, I think, is the unlawful killing of another person without the intention required for murder.
Okay.
And merely requires the foreseeability, objectively looked at, of some harm being caused.
Got it.
So, for example, let me give you an example. If I'm in a fight with somebody and I punch them and my use of violence is unlawful, I don't mean to kill them or to cause them really serious harm because I just give them one punch. But unbeknownst to me, that person is drunk. He falls backwards, bangs his head on the floor, fractures his skull and dies. That's a classic example of manslaughter rather than murder.
Yes.
Because a punch, you wouldn't expect to cause really serious harm.
And you wouldn't have maybe intended, as you say, you didn't intend to kill somebody.
No.
With the action that you took. But it's got to be an unlawful action and it's got to be unintended to be manslaughter rather than murder. And then we were talking about involuntary being part of that.
That's
so
right.
What's voluntary? So, well, we're going to come to the differences between them.
Yes.
So let's just say that that answers our first question. What's,
That's involuntary manslaughter. And the example I gave is known colloquially in the profession as a one-punch manslaughter.
Wow.
And there are many, many cases of that year in, year out.
I know somebody, I knew of somebody that was known to me through the friend of the friend of the friend that actually got convicted of that. Was exactly that. They were actually in Kentucky having chicken on a Friday night, came out, a brawl happened outside, they punched somebody, that one punch killed the person they punched.
Yeah.
They didn't intend to have a fight at all. They certainly didn't intend to kill, and that's what came out of it. Let's talk about some points, maybe the three main points that can define involuntary manslaughter, because now that I understand the voluntary manslaughter bit, and the involuntary manslaughter. What's voluntary? What is voluntary manslaughter?
Voluntary manslaughter, there are three ways in which you can be guilty of voluntary manslaughter. The first thing that I need to say about it is that for voluntary manslaughter, you need all of the ingredients of murder to be present. So in other words, you need an unlawful killing, and at the time, the person intends to either cause really serious harm or to kill. And so that's our standard definition of murder. But there are three sets of circumstances in which the offence of murder is reduced to manslaughter, voluntary manslaughter, and they are because the person acts through a loss of self-control or because they suffer from diminished responsibility. In other words, there's a substantial impairment of their mental functioning, which reduces their criminal liability. And the third way, which is a very rare form of voluntary manslaughter, is if the death is caused in pursuance of a suicide pact.
Yes.
And although the law decriminalized suicide many years ago, if you assist somebody to commit suicide, or if you kill them intending to then take your own life, and for whatever reason you don't or you fail, then that reduces what would otherwise be murder to manslaughter.
I get the diminished responsibility bit. I get the suicide pact bit. What I don't get, I really don't get, is the loss of control bit.
Right.
I don't get how that could fall, instead of murder and involuntary manslaughter, it falls into, well, instead of murder, actually, it falls into manslaughter. Because if you lose control of yourself because of anger, emotions, then that's, you know, that's what you shouldn't do, right?
Well, that's right. It used to be called provocation. And perhaps a lot of people understand the term provocation more.
Well, I do, because if you're provoked and you intend to kill, then murder. But what we're saying is, if that's the case, it still falls into manslaughter, but loss of control.
That's right.
Interesting.
The history of it is that when the Homicide Act was passed in the 1950s, which abolished the death penalty, the partial defence...
Was the death penalty only abolished here in the 1950s?
Yes.
God, that doesn't seem that long ago. I mean, I know I'm a bit of a dinosaur myself, but that doesn't seem so long ago. I thought it was way before that.
No.
Oh, that's another podcast. I'll have to write that down.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and in fact, in other countries, it was abolished far more recently. And of course, some countries sadly still have it. But as you say, that's a different topic. And so the Homicide Act created these defences of diminished responsibility and provocation. And the law on provocation became rather complicated. And so the Houses of Parliament amended the law and created this new version of provocation, which is called loss of control. And in fact, what the effect of that is to make the defence less available than it used to be as the old provocation.
Well, that's interesting, because you're absolutely right when you say that people understand provocation far better than saying loss of control. Because to me, as a layperson, loss of control is somebody, as I said earlier, I don't get it. If you've lost control and you've murdered somebody, that's murder in my layperson's brain, I guess. But if you say it's provocation and a reaction to provocation, then I kind of start getting it as why it could be used as a defence. So it's interesting. So what you're saying is they replace loss of control, provocation with loss of control, to make it less accessible as a defence.
Right.
Is that what we're saying?
And there's one very specific example that I can give you. A classic case of provocation was, you know, somebody coming home and finding their wife or husband or partner in bed with somebody else. And in the heat of the moment, they kill either the partner or the lover. That was the classic provocation.
But hold on. I get how we say that's an example of provocation, but I think that's, for me, to be provoked is somebody actually directly provoking you and getting you heated up. I know that seeing your partner in bed with somebody else is obviously a biggie. You're going to get upset, particularly if you're not expecting it, which most people are not, obviously. But I don't understand how that falls into provocation, really.
Well, it used to, but when they changed it to loss of control, sexual infidelity is specifically excluded as a reason for losing your self-control. And so that's the one big change that the law introduced. But the definition of loss of control is really quite complicated. But let me take you through it. There has to be a killing which results from a loss of control. The loss of control has to have what's called a qualifying trigger. Loss of control reduces murder to manslaughter. There's got to be this qualifying trigger. And you have to regard the defendant as a person of the same sex and age with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint. So that is the starting point. One of the changes in the law is that the loss of control doesn't have to be sudden. And the reason for this was, under the old law, women, particularly women, who were in an abusive relationship, who over the years
I've read abused. Yes.
What's referred to colloquially as battered women syndrome. Because it wasn't sudden, they couldn't avail themselves of the defensive provocation if they killed an abusive husband or partner.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting because I've read a couple of cases last year, actually, where women have killed their husbands after years and years of abuse.
Well, this sort of drip-feed provocation became recognised by the courts, and this was the other major change.
It's very interesting.
When provocation was replaced with loss of control. So the loss of control is something that can build up as a result of years and years.
I think that's a good thing. For that area of law, I think that's a really key thing. And I think it's a big move for people that are abused over years and years. I'm not saying, you know, it makes it right to go and kill somebody over it, but I do think it's a big move to try and protect that kind of defendant from those situations.
That's right. Having said which, one of the things that the law does state is that a considered desire for revenge cannot amount to lost control. So if you're acting in revenge for your husband or partner's treatment of you over the years, that would not be manslaughter by reason of loss of control.
Well, now you know why trials go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. Because to start arguing that and to prove that it was or wasn't, the finer points in the law to then say, was this, is this a defence to murder or not? It could take a long time in a courtroom.
And I mean, of all of the various options in homicide, I think loss of control is by far the most difficult. And you know, perhaps as you've referred to, is something that a jury would find more difficult to grasp as a concept than the old-fashioned provocation, because we all understand what provocation means.
Yes.
Most of us would like to think we don't ever lose our self-control, but of course some people do. Can I just go back to the qualifying trigger that I was talking
about? Yes, please
do. Because it's perhaps quite important to understand what that means.
Yes.
And so the loss of control has to be attributable to someone's fear of serious violence from the victim, from the person who dies, either against you yourself or against another identified person. So if, for example, somebody says to me, I am going to attack and beat up your son, and that causes me to attack them because I fear of serious violence towards another identified person, and I end up killing that person, potentially that is a qualifying trigger for my loss of control, and I'd be guilty of manslaughter, not murder. So it's either directed towards you personally or to another identifiable person. Clearly, if the identifiable person is somebody you have no connection with, it would be very difficult to control up as a defence. But it's perhaps important to make this point. If loss of control is raised by the defence, the prosecution have to disprove it in the same way they have to disprove self-defence.
Interesting.
Which is an absolute defence to murder or manslaughter. Whereas when we come on to the minute, if it's raised by the defence, it's for the defence to prove it on the balance of probabilities that diminished responsibility has made out.
Yes.
So as you can see, the law on voluntary manslaughter is incredibly complicated because in certain circumstances the prosecution have to disprove it, in other circumstances the defence have to prove it, and there are all these different factors that you have to have regard to.
Yes.
So going back to qualifying triggers, a fear of serious violence is one. Things done or said, or both, which constitute, and this is a phrase that I think anybody would struggle with, which constitutes circumstances of, and I quote, extremely grave character. Well, what that means is rather difficult to fathom, I think, and it's not defined. But all the law does say is that somebody has to feel seriously wrong in order for loss of control.
But this stuff, it would just be so up to interpretation, because as people, what I might find very offensive and something to the degree where I can't control myself, a million other people may not see it that way. So it's
precisely
right. So it just leaves everything up to that individual's really mindset and interpretation, whoever's evaluating that. And in this case, I'd say the jury potentially, or the prosecuting party, or, you know, the CPS when they're actually deciding whether to prosecute or not. Do they view it as it was something that was, you know, as a self-defense, or did they view it as something that was done out of a loss of control? Or, you know, it's so up for interpretation.
Well, it is. And of course, it brings you back to the fact that when you're considering the loss of control, you're considering a person of the defendant's age and sex with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint. So it's an objective test.
But what's a normal degree? This is it, though, Simon. What is classified as a normal degree of self-control?
Well, that, of course, is what the jury is there to decide. But if the things said or done of an extremely grave character, for example, apply to somebody's disability, their sexuality, their race, you can well see that those are things that person would take grave exception to and may well cause loss of control. And of course, if it's directed at a particular attribute, whether it be the color of somebody's skin, their sexuality or disability, then you have to graft that onto the reasonable person, if I can put it that way, and consider their tolerance and self-restraint. So it's a very difficult concept to ask a jury to wrestle with. I was just going to say, what is quite interesting, since provocation was replaced by loss of control, certainly in my experience, dealing with a lot of homicide cases as I do, it's raised as a defense far less than it used to be as provocation. Because, you know, if someone attacks me, for example, and I defend myself, you're much better running self-defense than you are loss of control.
Yes.
Even though a fear of serious violence from the victim towards you would be a qualifying trigger.
Mm.
And so you could run the alternative defences and say, well, I was defending myself. But even if the jury rejects self-defence, which the prosecution have to disprove, nevertheless, my fear of serious violence from this person is a qualifying trigger to make me guilty of manslaughter rather than murder.
Mm.
But surprisingly, that isn't run in an awful lot of cases. Defendants seem to prefer to go all out for self-defence.
If self-defense, yeah, if they feel that I lost control, and as because I was trying to self-defend myself,
absolutely.
I mean, let's face it, you know, criminal cases, particularly this sort of genre, murder, manslaughter, it's not something that normally, if you're trying to defend yourself in a self-defense, happens, you know, because you expected it to. If you didn't intend to kill someone, it normally, I would say, logically, it happens when you don't expect it to happen. So outline the reasons of, well, how did you get to that place? Was it self-defense? Was it diminished responsibility? Was it a loss of control? And obviously we take the suicide pact out of that, because that is more of a thought-out process, I'd say. It's a big area and very interesting. But the stark differences between involuntary and voluntary manslaughter, what would you say is the main, is there a main big difference between the two? I mean, we refer to, there's a term called mens rea, which means the mental element in a crime.
Yes.
Is that the stark difference? Is there what is it?
The mental element is the primary difference, because for involuntary manslaughter, you don't require an intention to kill or cause really serious harm. Whereas for all forms of voluntary manslaughter, that intention has to be there. Otherwise, you don't even get to the starting point
yes.
for any of the exceptions we've been talking about. And of course, if it's in relation to a suicide pact, by definition, the intention is to kill, not to cause really serious harm.
Yes, yes.
And so the net effect of that, and this is going back to what I said right at the start, which is why I think a lot of people fail to understand the complexities of manslaughter. The biggest difference is in terms of sentencing by the court, because you do find sentences being imposed for involuntary manslaughter, which to the ordinary person seem remarkably light. So going back to my one-punch manslaughter, for example, if I punch somebody and just, I don't know, cause them a bloody nose or a black eye or something, I may go to prison, I may not. If the net result of my single punch is that they fall over and fracture their skull and die, then there's an argument to say that my degree of culpability isn't that much greater than if I'd given them a bloody nose or a black eye.
When you put it like that, so when you, I get it. It's when you put it like that that I get it, though.
Yeah.
Because whatever happens, you know, and the press, I guess, play a massive part in it because they only report certain parts of things. And when you take a certain element of something, it can be very easily taken out of context. But when you hear somebody kill somebody and they got 2 years, right, as Joe blogs like me, I sit there and think, well, that's not right, is it? And the press will dress it up more often than not in the way which really highlights the worst of it, because they want people to read their articles. And you think, no, that's not right. We're going all soft as a nation in our laws. But we've just got a few more minutes, and I would love for you to talk to me about a case that you've been involved in where potentially the accused was charged with voluntary manslaughter, but they ultimately got convicted with involuntary manslaughter. And we've already mentioned a little bit, very little bit, about how that changes the sentencing.
Yes. You don't actually get... If someone's charged with murder and the jury convict of manslaughter, you only know what version of manslaughter the jury have convicted of if the judge asks for what's called a special verdict. So, for example, you can't... You're either guilty of voluntary manslaughter or involuntary manslaughter. You can't be guilty of both, for the simple reason, as I've explained, that the intention for murder is present in one, not present in the other.
So you wouldn't necessarily go in saying we're pleading involuntary manslaughter and not voluntary manslaughter. It would be we're pleading manslaughter or murder.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if you're pleading murder, you don't even have a trial, do you? You just...
No, quite.
Yes.
But, I mean, you can easily think of a scenario, for example, where somebody is charged with murder and they are saying, I was defending myself, defense number one. I lost my control, defense number two. I didn't intend to cause death or really serious harm, defense number three. And a defendant is entitled to argue all three of those defenses in the same trial. If the jury come back and say, not guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter, the sentencing judge doesn't know whether it's manslaughter because of loss of control. So there was an intention to kill or cause really serious harm, but the person lost their control, or because the jury weren't sure there was an intention to kill or cause really serious harm. And so what in those circumstances the judge would do is provide what's called a route to verdict, whereby the jury would either say, not guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter by reason of loss of control, or not guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter, which would then tell the judge that it was involuntary manslaughter, namely without the intention for murder. Because the sentence for, unless the loss of control was as a result of extreme provocation from the deceased, the sentence for loss of control manslaughter would be considerably longer in prison than for involuntary manslaughter.
And so, and this is why we spoke about doing a podcast on sentencing.
Absolutely.
Because you touched on that, and now I get it. I get it because of the whole involuntary, voluntary thing.
Yeah. And so because of the wide variety of options, which is unique to homicide, because in every other case, you can't run a selection of defences, but you can in murder. And the House of Lords before it became the Supreme Court, made it very clear that judges have to leave every possible defence to a jury on a charge of murder. And so it really is very important for the judge to know the basis on which he is passing sentence. Because if a jury convicted via one route of manslaughter and the judge sentenced on another route, then there's a potential injustice one way or the other, yes, either to the defendant or to the victim's family.
Very interesting stuff.
It's very important that the judge knows the proper basis on which he's passing sentence, he or she, I should say.
Yes, no, indeed. Simon, that's all we've got time for.
Well, we scratched the surface.
We did. We opened the tin, didn't we?
We did.
And that's the intention. No, it's very, very interesting stuff. And you made me ask another 20 questions in my head just as you were talking about the last bit of it all. But we will do sentencing because I think that's really important. And I think something you touched on makes it really interesting. And that is when we see in the papers that somebody killed somebody and got 2 years or 5 years, and you just don't think, well, you took somebody's life. Why are you not in prison for life? And I think that that will make a very interesting podcast. But thank you ever so much for joining me today.
Not at all, Hattie. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.